We're gonna assume that it is now on. Reality will just have to conform to the halachic claim. I'm feeling that I know this one works. Okay, so the first thing I gave you was excerpts of a poem by Robert Frost, Two Tramps in Mud Time, which I think is a beautiful introduction generally to any joint exercise of Talmud Torah. I heard in the Chavrutah already that some of you got what the obvious connection is. Nuth, what's the obvious thing we're talking about? Related to Torah.
Torah Lishma.
Torah Lishma. Right. So this to me, this day, as soon as I read it, I just came and said, "Wow, this is the best description of Torah Lishma should be that I've ever read." So you all have right. You have the plot, and the moral dilemma is worth discussing in its own case about whether it's legitimate to engage in to do for fun what people who need the work would do for pay. The obvious thing is, why don't you just give them the money and go on doing it, right, and go on doing it yourself, and that relates to the whole question of the dignity of work and what kind of things are preferable at Sukkah, and things like that. Not our issue today. What we're interested in specifically is his description of Lishma, which starts from, we should work in his premise. Right. His premise is that where his right is love and theirs is need, where the two exist in twain, theirs was the better right. Okay, so he works on the premise, right? So he works on the premise that he can't actually, right? Whether he's right or not is not my issue. But he works on the premise that he can't actually justify doing it for fun if other people need the work and that's all that's going on. Right? But this is all for our purposes, background to the scene, right, but yield who will to their separation. My object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation as my two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one and the work is play for mortal stakes is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sakes. Now, when I do this as a shir about this poem, so the next stage is to quote the Pasuk in Tehillim, Lulei Taratcha She'ashui, Azavati Bani, right, where we have explicit treatment of Torah as a source of fun, the plaything, so to speak. Chavrutah Moshe Raymond introduced that to me a long time ago. And then we go on to the introduction of the Egle Tal, right, who talks about the necessity for enjoying Torah, right, as part of the experience of really learning Torah Lishma, and has a diatribe against those people who think that having fun is a diminution of Talmud Torah. Again, we could talk about whether fun is the right word as opposed to joy, and how you distinguish fun and joy, all sorts of things like that. But let's talk on the core lines that we're interested in, as only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes. So how do you guys understand, if you have to frame in your own words, how would you frame the claim being made in that quadruplet, whatever you call it? I guess that's a couplet, so to speak. New? Yes, Rachel.
So it seems to me that it's saying really, sort of, at least in my mind, there would have almost been like a hava mina that I would have thought, oh, only where you love something, therefore you were doing at least shema for heaven's and future's sake. But really it's saying only where love and need are one, where there is an essential need to do it, whether it's part of it is your own desire, part of it is you're commanded to, part of it is that you must do it for pay and to provide, and as well as your own personal desire to take it on, and that combination is the only way to truly fulfill doing it for heaven's and future's sake.
Okay, so you have your hot choice there for you, the hava mina, is that love would be sufficient.
Yeah.
All right, and the maskana is that no, you need both love and need. Interesting. Now, we should point out, though, that it seems more likely for him that need is the hava mina, because he thinks that need trumps love. Except that maybe that's not about lishma.
Right. If we're working on the premise of it could be like Torah lishma.
Okay, all right, you immediately put need, right, which is certainly the argument ongoing, right, that need and commandedness are connected. Okay, anyone else? Right, how do you understand? Right, so love is what you want to do, and need is,
Right, needed a fuzzier term, right? Because commandedness or economic need don't seem like really like they should be the same thing. And yet, right?
Sort of reminiscent of like a Sarah and Sakir to now kind of thing.
Uh huh. Yeah. Okay.
That
right.
Love is the need.
Did you, what do you want to say?
No.
Just that. No one else. Anyone else think this is Pashut? Do you agree with this?
Explanation or with him?
Assuming that explanation is what Frost claims, do you agree with the right? Do you find that a compelling definition of what Lishma is?
Well, so Lishma what? I mean, his faith is heaven and the future.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, is that the definition of Lishma we're working with?
So that's really interesting, right? So heaven's sake sounds very much like Lishem Shemayim. Right, which may or may not be the same thing as Lishma. And the future is a category that isn't quite so, that doesn't really exist in Jewish terms. Right, and maybe that changes things. That's right, certainly right. Yes, you did, yeah.
I feel like neither of these is Lishma, because one is Lishma and one is Lishmi.
Uh-huh.
Right? You're either doing it for yourself, or you're doing it, I don't know what the compulsion is, right? You know, because, as let's say, it's your job, it's your own mother, or just because there's a mitzvah, so it's for God, right? But none of those is Lishma for the actual sake of the work itself that you actually care about.
Aha. Okay. So working on the premise that Lishma means for its right for its own sake.
Right. And right. Frost doesn't seem to value the chopping of the wood in and of itself. Right. He values it in so far as it's aesthetically pleasing to have what it were, rather than forget what the passage was. So, the ease of the earth and the life of muscles rocking stock. Yeah, it's very nice for him, but it doesn't really say that the act of chopping wood is something that's worthy, in and of itself of being done.
Uh-huh. Okay. And that assumes that that's the vision of Lishma that is usually attributed to Chaim Volozhin. Right, that Lishma, Torah Lishma specifically means Torah for its own sake as opposed to Torah Lishem Shemayim. We could talk about whether that's true or not. I don't find it really true. But that Rav Chaim Volozhin really said that. But we can go on. Yes, ma'am.
So just thinking about the idea of Lishma and Lishmi, I was wondering, if you have for heaven and the future's sake, one way to read that is that heaven's sake is the fact that he loves doing it, and that love is somehow connected with heaven, and the future sake is the need, because when you're fulfilling the need, you're allowing your children to have food. And then one thing I was wondering is, would a legitimate way to read that be a sort of, when the two things come as one, we have both heaven and the future sake, or are both do both heaven and future sakes necessitate having both?
That's a good question. All right, that's a fine example of sexual analysis. I would go for the second, but I can't prove it. So you can certainly... I think that the sense of the poem would be lost if you could still bifurcate two different kinds of sakes, because the whole point is unity, and if at the end you just split it apart and you say, well, really, it's, right, in order to have both heaven and the future, you need to have both love and need, but you could have, but love could be, right, I think that would mess it up. I can't demonstrate it, but I think that it would mess it up. Yes, Rachel.
I mean, I was just thinking it definitely complicates the somewhat simplistic understanding that many people have of what is Lishem Shamayim, or rather, what kind of sense are you supposed to get or feel as a result of doing something Lishem Shamayim? That if, my object in living is to unite my avocation and my vocation, well, if that's your goal, I mean, that could be easy to achieve, but I would think that at least in terms of Talmud Torah, it's a sort of a delicate balance that you would feel the need to do it and the want to do it every time you do it.
A challenge?
Is a challenge that I think to really be able to always fulfill it whenever you're doing it and realize that there's a need for it and that you desire it all the time. It's probably a hard thing to do at the
and
same time.
There's another definition of Torah Lishma that's an easy thing to do all the time? that doesn't bother me so much. Right? I think there are much higher standards of Lishma that are much harder to meet. The other, pardon?
He has my object to live in. That's the point of his life to do it, I guess. Right, a life goal.
So let's Okay, so let's frame it. Let's frame this differently. Is there such a thing as, right, if you say what is one's vocation as a Jew? Right, so right, what does it mean to have, right, as a Jew, to have a vocation?
Depends who you ask.
Depends who you ask. Is it, I think a fairly standard answer would be that your vocation as a Jew is to keep halacha and learn Torah. Right, those are the things that one needs to do as a Jew.
Called.
Yeah, it's a vocation, right? A vocation is what you're called to do, and avocation is, right, is what you call yourself to do, right? I think that's probably right etymologically, no? And then, what do we do with a Jew who has an avocation? And, right, so, what is there room in halachic Jewish culture for the division between the avocation and the vocation, or put more sharply, right, this goes into Aseret Tzoncha, do we say to anybody who feels an avocation distinct from the performance of halacha and the study of Torah, that their task in life is to unite their avocation and vocation by being vatil ritzonam b'snei ritzono? Right, the goal is to make your you should become the kind of person whose avocation is to keep halacha and study Torah.
United with are very different.
So it is. So it is. Absolutely right. So I don't think, right, I don't think that that is the point of the poem. Right, I think the point of the poem, right, is that you have avocation and vocation. You have to bring them together, and we're open to the notion, right, how you do that. Right, how you do that, you know, the movement, right, how you do that, the poem doesn't tell you, but it sounds like you can either find a way to make your avocation your vocation, or make your vocation your avocation. And it's not clear which one's easier. Right, probably it's easier to go and try, you know, it's an interesting question, why is it that the protagonist of this poem doesn't become a lumberjack? That's really what he loves doing, right? So why doesn't he unite his avocation and his vocation? Right, the underlining is he doesn't want to be poor or unemployed. He doesn't want to be the person watching the other person who's having fun. Right, we could ask the question whether he would really enjoy wood chopping if it were his vocation as opposed to his avocation. Right, that's a tension.
It's the thing that makes it desirable, the fact that he doesn't actually have to do.
That's right. Right, and it may be that underlying the tension is that he recognizes this. That his goal in life is to unite his avocation and vocation, but he hasn't found a way. He's doing it for himself. Right? He's chopping his own wood. I think if maybe the excerpt misses that. I think he's chopping his own wood, right? So he's not. The money he's taking is the money he would otherwise give to them. I don't know if he grew up rich or he is rich. Yeah.
Well, I also think you could either say that, you know, my object in living is to unite my avocation, and my vocation is that supposed to be sort of a goal that's very flexible, that's very easy, or is it a hindrance and it's very difficult to unite the two? I'm not sure which way he sees it, as being a challenge or an invitation.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to start calling on people because we're getting the same people talking all the time. So, Aura, what does it mean? What does it mean to say that the work is play for mortal things? By the way, I know this is, I believe, a Spencer novel by Robert Parker is titled Mortal Stakes. And all Spencer novels start with cute quotes. I think that's where I got this from. I have read through Frost, but I didn't remember that line. I think we're supposed to think quotes in one place also.
because if your work is done because you like doing it, it can't really have like an impact on the future or have like a, it doesn't have any more meaning to have like past that like your enjoyment.
Okay. What does mortal stake specifically, what does that mean?
Mortal stake is like on earth more.
You think it's just that?
Yeah.
Let's try. Someone have a... Ezra, what do you think mortal stakes mean?
When I think mortal, I think death. So, not long-term.
Not long. You think that too. Wow. All right. Yes, Emily.
I think it's the opposite. I think, not the opposite, but mortal stakes makes it sound like very profound and important. Like, if you want there to be something that has, like, real stakes and, like, real claim in your life and in the world in general, then if that can only happen when love and need are united.
You think... That can only happen when love is united. It's not right. We use Greg Miriam's analysis. The question is, and the work is played for mortal stakes. Is that a perish on love and need or one, right? Or is it an additional condition, right? You need love and need being one, and the work being played for mortal stakes. Well, when you play for stakes, well, let's take. What does it mean to play for stakes? What are we talking about?
There's something at stake.
Gambling, right? We're talking about gambling, okay? And that means that there has to be a possibility of winning and a possibility of losing. Otherwise, you're not playing for stakes. Okay, and when you're playing for mortal stakes, so we're talking life or death. Right, so I think the work is played for mortal stakes means that, right, that the, on the one hand, it's work. On the other hand, you have to recognize you're part of a game. And the game, right, the game has to have a win and a loss. And that's a hard thing to try and figure out what is there about a task, right, which is life or death. Right, what I want to argue, right, is that it's not just, right, it's easy to frame it as, well, there's life or nothing. Right, but it's not life or nothing, right? As mortal stakes means it has to be life or death. Right, so real lishma is achieved when you have love and need, and the need has to rise to the level of life or death, which is what's going on, right, because they're starving. Right, the lumberjacks are starving, so they have work for mortal stakes, but it's not play. Right, he's playing. Okay. So, well, we could happily spend, I would love to spend an hour and a half just talk, or a lifetime just talking about what this poem means. Really, where did that? I wanted to move it into the context of the Torah for now, concretely. So here's the first question I want to ask. What do we do, religiously, with somebody who tells us that their avocation and or their vocation is not the performance of halacha or the study of Torah per se? Yes,
I do. I feel like if you have a violent inclination, then you should become a shochet or a moel or something like that. So there's this idea of kind of channeling your inclination. Halacha is pretty broad, and so you can kind of channel your inclination towards performing.
So you think your avocation is killing, and so we unite your avocation and your vocation, I think
yeah, that's
what I remember. Interesting. There is such a thing, right? Okay. Usually people are more into calling that sublimation.
I would think about it, the vocation is by far the more important one.
It's not like that. The vocation isn't important at all. It just happens to be a way of controlling. Right. That's right. That's you can do that. Right. You can say, let's find a way to give you a concretely halachically meaningful expression of this thing you desire to do. It can be positive or negative. Right. It's just an expression of a characteristic. It's actually not a desire to do anything. Right. So that's one way of framing it. Right. I think that's a sort of reductionist. Right. Where there's but it's a way of framing it so that really, once again, the only expressions that matter are halachic. Right? If it wasn't shechita, right? Like we don't tell you to go off and do, I don't know. The interesting question, what happens if we say, you know what, you have this desire to kill things, so why don't you go off and slaughter meat and work in a meatpacking factory, non-kosher? Right? Would we be as happy about that? After all, you're restraining your impulses. I don't know, right? Or is this just...
Really good
question. We tend to say yes, we make a bracha.
Can you guess on that?
Psychological enough?
That goes. I don't know if you can work at McDonald's.
McDonald's halachic problem because of Buster Bechalov, maybe. Right, but there's no Yisra Noah against you know, non-kosher meat. Right, the Vela, right, it only says, like, El Tashli Chonoto. Sorry, what, you did it?
No, that's
right. So what are your own takes, right? What happens if somebody says, you know what, my avocation in life is to play with numbers, so I'm going to go be an accountant. And that way I will really, you know, or a CPA, right? And that way my vocation in life are united. Now look, I'm going to be perfectly Shomer Shabbos down to the texting. And I will, and I'll go to a Shira Shabbos afternoon and sleep through most of it so that I formally fulfill the Talmud. I was very mocked about saying Kriyat Shema Shabbos and Arvid. Right? And I remember I learned that Gemara in the Nachos once, that you can be Yotzir Chiyav Talmud Torah by saying Kriyat Shema morning and evening. And that's how I want to live my life. And I think that you should celebrate my capacity to unite my vocation and my avocation. So even in the context of frost, we have a response to that. What's wrong with that? What's missing?
It wasn't for mortal
stakes. And it wasn't for mortal stakes. If you weren't an accountant, you would die. I guess, right? If you turn out to be a bad enough accountant.
No, if you don't have what would to make a living, I mean.
Right. I guess, right? You can say every job is mortal stakes in that sense.
What do you think
he's
talking about there?
Well, most of us, the job, you know, starvation and working in our field are not directly connected. You could work somewhere else and not starve. Right? But the point is, these people only have that one profession. Right, whereas accountants could, I don't know what else accountants could do.
Not very much,
I suppose. Most of them could probably get jobs, I don't know. Interesting question. Maybe we can overqualify people to the point where either you're the CEO of a Fortune 500 corporation or you starve to death. Well, I haven't heard of so many cases of former CEOs of Fortune 500 corporations starving to death because of unemployment.
Well, if we're talking about avocation and sort of like a field, try to go into any other field, you won't have the qualifications for it, you won't have the resume for it. And then if you had to leave your avocation field, you would have to be retrained, and in the interim, if you have no way to make a living, presumably you would die.
So maybe we can make it a default that way, reclaim it. I don't think you'll have that consciousness. Right? People don't go to work every day saying, something to do, right? You know, you can feel that, like, if I don't go to work, I won't pay day school tuition, and my kids won't be from. Right, and you know, and you're allowed to be mechallel Shabbos, right, to keep your kids from being not from, so that makes it pikuach nefesh. So therefore, making enough money to pay day school tuition is pikuach, right, is life and death. You could do that, and that would be a way of framing it, right. So what I want to get out of that is to make the claim that so halacha and Torah have an easy way of making the claim that everything is mortal stakes. Right, it's not easy, right, it's not hard to make the claim, right? You just say, look, you know, there's heaven, there's hell. You do this, you do that. Right, you go here, you do this, there. Right? Every time you do a mitzvah, right? When we say to people, right, that when the Rambam says, in Hilchos Teshuva, that everybody should look at themselves every moment as if the world is in perfect equipoise, and the next avera, right, sends the world into the void, and the next mitzvah, right? So what's he saying? He's saying is that every mitzvah act should be viewed, right, you should perceive it as being played for mortal stakes. Right, the entire future depends on you. Right? But what would we do halachically if somebody doesn't frame what they're, right, do we have room in halachic society for somebody who feels a very strong application and a very strong vocation and unites them and feels that it's for mortal stakes, but has no specific halachic framework to describe their combined avocation and vocation.
Does it have one personally or one that exists?
There isn't one that they can tell you or that you can say. You can always imagine one, but no one has yet come up with an articulation.
Well, anything which we're
we're talking about occasion for mortal things, as that whole gravitation and that halakha.
No, but they only feel it for mortal things.
Okay.
Right. Their sense is, I'll give you an autobiographical thing, which, you know, which relates to the theme. There was a painter named Piet Mondrian. Have you ever heard of him? Piet Mondrian. Yeah, well, he does right angles and primary colors. Right, that's all his paintings are, right, often giant canvases of right angles and primary colors. Broadway Boogie Woogie is his most, right, is perhaps the climax. So there are a lot of compositions in red, compositions in yellow, compositions in red and yellow, compositions in red, yellow, and blue. If you look, I can bring in the book of his works. You can, right, it's, first of all, you know, they're easy to make to say that they're Mutter, right? But you can see that, right, he didn't originally start off doing that. He began by being a perfectly conventional representational paper, a painter, and over time he moved more and more into believing that he could essentialize everything into that. He even came up with a whole philosophy called neoplasticism to explain why it was that everyone should really paint in primary colors, right angles. I'm not sure that anyone has read that in a long, long time. As you can see, it's very easy to make fun of this. And I actually, my first exposure to Mondrian was in a novel called The Burglar Who Painted Like Mondrian, the plot of which was somebody stealing a Mondrian. By the end of the book, there are four or five different copies of this Mondrian around, and the point is that nobody can tell the difference, because after all, how do you tell the difference between an authentic and inauthentic painting that is composed of bright angles and primary colors? you can do it yourself, right? What's the big deal? So at one point I went to a museum for a Mondrian exhibit, and figuring that I think I went with somebody who was studying to be an art curator or something. And I went figuring that this would be an amusing evening, because look, there's this whole museum of paintings that are right angles and primary colors. Right, you know, and all spend the time making fun of it. Hey, I could do that, or all that thing. And I was transfixed. I was totally transfixed. I had to be dragged out of there. Because it was just an overwhelmingly powerful experience. In which I could get this real sense that, to understand why he would feel that if this straight line were moved an eighth of an inch that way, he spent lots of time moving his line an eighth of an inch this way and that way to get it right, then the whole world would collapse. Like everything depended on, right, on getting it right. Now, this may be an experience you can relate to or an experience you can't relate to. It may be, right, it may be that you've never felt that way about anything in your life, you know, to have a sense that, other than Torah mitzvahs, that if you got it, if it went this way, then that was terrific, and if it went that way, then, you know, then existence becomes meaningless. But the question I want to ask is, on the presumption that for many people, that their production of art plays that role. Right? That it is their avocation and their vocation not in the sense that they feel economically dependent on it, but their vocation in the sense that they feel called upon to do this. This is their tafkid in life. So, do we have? Do we have a halachic language to articulate, and do we have the resources in halacha to describe what it means to live that life religiously? The way I framed it in our Torah last night was, you know, one stark way of framing it. It's not the only way we could do it. Is to say that if you acknowledge the possibility that there are meaningful vocations in life that are not simply the expression of halacha or Talmud Torah, which is not necessary. You can also make the claim that any vocation in life we can put halachic language to. Right? You can say, like, you don't have a vocation to be a doctor. You have a vocation to fulfill v'rapo yirapei. And we paskin the v'rapo yirapei is a mitzvah. Right? So now we found a way, right? You think you want to be a doctor, you don't really want to be a doctor. You want to be mekayim this mitzvah. Right, yes?
Well, I think it also raises the complicated question of, does it change sort of the worth or the value of doing a mitzvah because you desire to do the mitzvah or you desire to do the action which happens to be a mitzvah, and sort of like, I mean, I think it was Yeshayahu he was the one who propounded, you know, I don't take any pleasure and I intentionally try not to take any pleasure or personal emotional benefit out of fulfilling mitzvot, because then I would be sort of doing an avera.
Yeah, worshiping myself, it's me'ilah, right? All right, there's a phrase, right? You know, the risk reward, that's why you have to make brachos, because, right, because to do a mitzvah is, right, you only get hanah from mitzvah if you make a bracha. There are all sorts of problematic issues with that. I don't want to go, I mean, you can take the Leibovitzian position if you want. I'm sorry with Eglay Tell is the exact opposite, so at least in Talmud Torah, there's another way. But I'm saying there's a strategy. One strategy is to find a way to articulate it, right? So for art, the easy way to do that is to say, oh, look, it's Hidur Mitzvah, right? You have an avocation and vocation to do Hidur Mitzvah. The problem is that doctors may sometimes feel that their vocation is to heal, or they may sometimes feel their vocation is to be doctors, right? And artists may, as we'll see, may not be motivated by Hidur Mitzvah at all. They may have entirely different motivations. So the way I framed it last night is, you can set up a chakira this way, right? And I'll use halakhic language, right? Which is one way of framing it. This seems to be the way the Maimonides school motto currently frames it, is that halakha and Torah express the totality of religiously meaningful life. So we can only give meaning to things if we can find halakhic language for them. And the other way is saying that halakha and Torah creates the context of religious life in which many other things can be meaningful. Right? So it might be that we believe that if you can find a way in which you feel that exercising that developing the perfect jump shot is somehow for mortal sakes, right, that's your art form, is developing the perfect jump shot. So then, okay, as long as, right, you know, if you somehow plausibly feel that the world depends on your jump shot being perfect, because there is something introduced into the world because of the perfect jump shot, right, Walter Davis, before your time, Walter Davis had allegedly had the perfect jump shot, right, so then that's something for you. Yes, Emma?
Okay, so you just said that the second option would be that halakha and Torah create a context in which other things could be meaningful.
Yes.
But other things and other things being your vocation or avocation are different. Like, there could be things that have meaning without them being your calling in life.
True. But I think it's easier to say, you know what, halakha leaves room for other things, you know, the rakachos and tabachos of life. Right? As opposed to saying that this is who I am.
Right, I agree with you. Right. So which question are you asking?
You could modify it, and you could claim, right, you could do that analysis and claim, you know what, we have room for art or jump shooting or things like that as meaningful so long as you recognize what primary meaning is and what secondary meaning is. I'd rather confront the question straight on and say, no, you know what, people who feel that way often feel that really is the primary meaning in life, and we have to decide if we have three approaches. We can oppose that and saying that this is wrong. Right, really, your vocation in life is to do mitzvot and learn Torah. And so, if you have something that can't be translated that way, or that you don't even feel can be translated that way, then let's break you of that. I have a second possibility, which is let's co-opt it, and we'll explain to you, even if you don't really understand it, that what you're really doing is halakha or Torah. And a third possibility is to say, you know what? Yeah, I don't necessarily. That's fine, as long as you fulfill halakha and your minimal mitzvot Talmud Torah, we're okay with that. How am I defining halakha? As of now, I guess the complex of the system of legal obligations under in Judaism.
Well, you mentioned before Hidur Mitzvah, would that fall into the category of an obligation?
Sure. Or certainly a kiyum. Why not? One of the 613
in
some kind.
Right? In terms of thinking about the second thing you said is putting things in the context of halakha, depending on how broadly you define halakha, it could be easier or harder to do that. And I mean, I don't know, there's the context of doing what you, I mean, then it sort of
goes into Jewish philosophy and how you view the world, but you can say that doing something, creating a piece of art, can inspire people in ways you don't know about, or bringing a new idea into the world can cause something. I don't know, I guess lots of things have lots of ramifications, which somewhere along the lines can be translated into something.
That's right, that's co-opting. You can do that. The question is, right, is, do you believe it? Right? Do you really believe that's why, right? Do you really believe that the reason that the reason that you became a printer is so that you could print life insurance policies so that, right, somewhere along the line some poor widow will inherit the money and that will keep her children from starving to death, so the reason that I'm a printer is for Pikuach Nefesh? Right? And if it wouldn't happen, right, if that weren't a possibility, then being a printer would be religiously meaningless, or not?
I guess what I was trying to say is more on the experience of, I think of an art form in terms of creation, but like, let's say you enjoy selling life insurance, then maybe you're, again, depending on what Jewish philosophy you take, maybe Halacha wants you to be happy, and...
We can say that, you know what, maybe Halacha allows you to be happy, right? Wants you to be happy, but you know, you can take the claim anything that makes you happy is valuable. But then it's only valuable because it makes you happy.
Yeah.
Right? So you can take that, right? Those are all possibilities. Right? They won't, you know, it doesn't work so well necessarily to tell people that this thing that you find valuable is valuable because you find it valuable. Right, when they might want you to, they might want to believe that the thing that they find valuable is valuable because it is.
What does that mean? What does find valuable?
I don't know. Find out. All right. So that's the first issue I want to set up as a framing. Now, how do you read Anim's Mirot? Now, I understand that some of you already had much more sophisticated understanding of Anim's Mirot than I do. I have a very shallow understanding of Anim's Mirot. Perhaps, but here's what I wanted to get out of Anim's Mirot. Anim's Mirot deals with attention. What's the attention? Yeah.
We can't ascribe physical or really any sort of descriptions to God, but the only way that we can have a relationship or any sort of thoughts about God is if we do, so therefore we try and make the best attempt that we can in describing his actions. And therefore, that helps us describe who he is.
Okay. We describe his act, right? So we can frame this very abstractly, right? We want to know God, but we can't, right? But we don't know God, so we describe God by his, right? By his actions, right? By Shavucha Lefim Asecha, right? So we describe, right? That we limit him to his act, right? We equate him to his actions, and we have this Maimonidean distinction between essential and accidental attributes. Okay. Good. Right. So now we can remove Anim's Mirot from the Siddur, and we will now replace Anim's Mirot with this statement. Right. We wish to have a relationship with God, however, in order to have a relationship with God, we need to talk about him, but since we don't know God's essence, we are required to talk about his actions instead. God is great and merciful. Right? God is, you know, that wouldn't work really well, right? It wouldn't catch on, it right, doesn't have a beat.
Little kids won't make it well at all. Okay, let's start with, is Anim's Mirot in fact a catalog of actions? Regina, you haven't talked yet. Is Anim's Mirot in fact a catalog of actions?
No.
No, what is it a catalog of?
Description of God's glory.
Description of
like
glory?
Anthropomorphic descriptions of God.
That's exactly right. Right?
Glory.
It's a catalog of anthropomorphic images of God. Right, that's pretty straightforward. Now, what legitimates? Jared, what legitimates this? Why are we allowed to talk about God as having all sorts of human characteristics? Old, young, white hair, black hair, the whole gamut. What makes it okay?
We're acknowledging it's just a metaphor, it's not...
We just say kibyachol, so it's fine. Is that enough for Anim's Mirot? Right, what more do you have to do? in Anas Nirot.
You have to write it.
Right, so Anas Nirot is a catalog of anthropomorphic descriptions in Navi of God, right? So, right, so what Anas Nirot does is, right, is it says we have this desire to describe God. We can't describe God, but we have to describe God, so the answer is other people have already described God. And we are allowed to repeat those descriptions so long as we don't make the claim that those descriptions are of his essence. Yes, Ezra. I don't believe there is any image in Anas Nirot that is not directly drawn from, right? You can check me on that, but I don't think there's any image in Anas Nirot that isn't directly drawn from Tanakh.
Or
Midrash. Well, okay, so now we're going to talk about what Tanakh means. Right? Veritha, right? So the Midrash, right? So the Kesher Tefillin HaRa'alanav is for the purposes of this song, Veritha Zacharai. Panai Lo Yiro. Right? So it's not bound by Pshat Tanakh, right? But it's not, right? But it's on the assumption that's what that meant, I think. Right? Yes.
Also, I'm not sure how literally, quote unquote, we're defining the word metaphor, because you could say that it's all examples referenced in Tanakh, but if you believe that Tanakh was divinely inspired or divinely originated, then that you could say that even these anthropomorphic qualities were really God's words to describe himself. And
sure.
Therefore, why would we have any trouble, sort of, why... It seems that almost the poet in the beginning is giving like a disclaimer for what he's about to do. And if we were working with more of an assumption that, oh, well, of course we have descriptions for God because God describes God and these are the characteristics, then the poet wouldn't seem to go to such trouble to almost introduce this whole...
Uh-huh. So it doesn't sound like it's so safe.
Right,
right.
It sounds like he's making a slippery slope when maybe it isn't, if we assume that these references from Tanakh were from God anyway. Uh-huh. I think he
gives the Nevi'im a little bit more credit. they're describing their experiences. It's not that God gave them the language. Mm-hmm. Right? This is how they experience God, and they're describing what they experience in language. Yes, Jonathan?
And I can't help but doing this, but the reason that the Anas Nirot has to reference Nevuah is not, I think, contextually where Anas Nirot is written, because we can describe God, we just need to use some other language. It's that, right, the context in Sefer Chassidim is a great machlokas between, you know, that's quoted as to what the kavod is and what do Nevi'im see.
Yeah.
It's a great machlokas what the kavod is, and once they describe what they think the kavod is, right, as opposed to the opinion of Rastajigon, then the Kavod Nivra, that's something which is not related to God, it's a secondary creation that God created for the sole purpose of being seeing it, right? The opinion of the Ashkenaz, that the Kavod is the part of God that Nivim can't see, that's what it is by definition. Right? It's the lower part of God, you know, it's the parallel practice of Shiro. Right, therefore, right here, it's a very specific reason. Right? It's not just, I would like to describe you, but I can use what other people quote. It's, they're talking with a kavod, which is that part of God which can be and see. Right, so it's a very technical term. Right, kavod here is the glory, it means the kavod.
I'm fine with that.
It's a proper noun.
I'm fine with that, although you're way more up on that than I am. I don't see that it changed, but I think that the claim that what the poem is saying is, well, you know what, I want to talk about God, and it's perfectly fine because I'm just talking about the Kavod. Right? It doesn't get what's going on.
No, it's I want to understand. Right, the first, right, the, after the introductory line, the first four lines, right, are right, set up the parallelism, right? You want to Harat Sadefa, right, which is the Kavod. I want to understand your secrets, and the only thing that we can understand is the Kavod. And the Kavod is that part of God which the Nevi'im saw, and this is how the Nevi'im describe it.
I don't think it will change what I'm trying to say. I don't. Tell me after that. I think it's that, right? You know, all it does is cordon off certain things, aspects of God you can't say. It still sets up rules as to how you can describe what you can and can't do. I think. right? But now we just talk about the rules are for talking about the kavod, right? And there's an ein sof or whatever you want to call it beyond that you can't talk about. I don't think it changes what I'm trying to say. Although maybe it does. So let's talk, right? So here's right. This is the issue that matters to me, right? Is there a in the context of this poem, what happens if somebody comes up with their own description of right with their own description of God? Right, what would happen if somebody sat down and said, "I'm not a Novi, right? But God to me is like you know, God to me is very much like, pardon?" Or the headmaster of a school of wizardry, whatever, right? whatever your own image. I was going to bring in, I may yet bring in, you know, I have a this very cool kids book called The 6 Days of Creation, in which God is an architect wearing a hard hat. So, in the context of the poem, what do we think of that? You can't. Why not? Wouldn't be in the poem. That's two very different things, right? So one vision. We're looking for the air conditioning leak. Sure. So great. So what is? There's a difference between saying, right? One way of reading it is to say that, you know what? There's nothing wrong with trying to describe God. It's just that I don't have any basis for describing God, so I'm going to right. Or I don't. That's not my purpose right now. My purpose right now is to collect and write to anthologize previous descriptions of God. Right. The second way of reading it is to say that describing God is a terribly dangerous thing. And the only way, right, the only way in which I will allow myself to describe God is if is by using language from authorized descriptions. Right, this is parallel to the Gemara about why, you know, about how dangerous it is to praise God, right? Because you can never praise God totally. So we take the Matea, the Nashik, Nasa, Zagdola, they got it right, and we assume that, right, we don't have to worry about taking silver coins, praising God for having silver coins when really he has gold. Right, so is what you're saying, Jonathan, that the second reading is not plausible in that scholarly view or not? The second view, that it's dangerous. Do you think they have no issue at all with descriptions?
No, I think they do. I think it's more than dangerous. I agree with your claim. I think if the claim being made specifically here is more extreme, right, that we can't know anything about God, the only way we can is through visions of the Kavod, right, and therefore the only way we can do that is talk about visions of the Kavod. Concerning the context, the original context is trying to figure out what did the Nevi'im see, right, what can we, and what is that Kavod, right, so it's more than dangerous, it would be nonsensical to make up terms of what wasn't actually visions of the Kavod.
Is there a time when we could get to the ceiling here?
We'll be done before 3, for sure.
Do you know, would we be able to move to a different room for a little bit so they can take a look, or, you know,
I'd much rather commit to finishing by 2:45. Can you work around this? Because
let me see what they say. Yeah.
Okay.
They're gonna look outside first.
So. Okay. Right. They have to be able to move to the social. It reverberates. So. Okay. So here's where I want to go with this, because I don't want to make too much depend on this, because it's only useful. I wasn't taking Anazimir as a primary text. It's useful in just a notion. I read Anazimir as play for mortal stakes, right? Describing God is what you have to, right? A work that is play for mortal stakes. You have to describe God, right? That's what your vocation as a religious being is, to understand God. And that means you don't have the choice of simply abandoning the effort and saying, "I won't talk about God." And I think this is true in many different areas of life, just thought Anazimir is the most powerful version of it. Anthropomorphism is a real danger, because nobody should think that that's what God really is, an old man or a young man or a warrior, right, or whatever it may be. But you have to do it anyway. Now, what I want to
play out with that is that many understandings of halakha are really not so compatible with a notion of a religious life that is played for mortal stakes on any axis other than obedience and disobedience. Meaning that, so let's say I will, my teacher Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik used to talk about what Yerideya was. Right, so Yerideya was traffic laws. Right, and it was and driving manuals, and the goal, the way we really live halacha is driving manuals and traffic laws, meaning that it's how to avoid anything ever going wrong. Right, and Yerideya tells us what happens after the accident. But the goal of the halachic life in kashrut, right, nobody would say the goal of halachic life in kashrut is to see just how close you can come to eating basar b'challah without actually doing so. Right, you have a fun, fun halachic daredeviling, right? Let's see. Right, here we are, right? You know, one in 60.0001 parts, right? Watch the 001s go down as you keep adding the drop of milk, and let's see if we can get just enough, right, while it's cooking, so that you're over the bishul, right? So, right, we can have all sorts of games like that that you could play. That the people, the reverse vasikin, the people who wait till the last moment to say Kriyat Shema, right? So they can. That's not usually the conception of what halachic life is supposed to be. Usually halachic life is about safety, right, and building in margins, and right, and right, one of the first images we get is, you get it, whether you start with Pirkei Avot as sort of the thematic introduction, or you start at Brachot, the first thing you learn is Siag LaTorah. Right, we try and build fences to make sure there's no risk, So it can, play for mortal stakes can be seen as deeply opposed to the ethos of halachic life. And that raises a whole challenge about what happens if you have people who define their avocation and vocation in ways that inherently put them at risk. Right, that put them on the line. Let's say, if you see your purpose in life as describing God. So, how well is it going to work? Right, we all know what the gzera is. Don't. Right, that's what the siag is. Don't. Now, so I want to argue, is that in that world, right, in a world which conceives of halacha that way, Anez Mira can't get written. Because there will be derabbanans against it. Now, it may be that that's not the only way to conceive of halacha. It may be that there are areas in which we have derabbanans and areas in which we don't have derabbanans. It may be that we conceive of derabbanans but we conceive of derabbanans as vacatable for all sorts of reasons, right? And so among those reasons are kvod habriyot and cholish ein bo sakana, and maybe there are other things. Right, which we are willing to say you can take chances with regard to them. So what I wanted you to do with reading in Shu'at Amanut, and I really just want it in your head, I don't want to have the conversation now, is to raise the, right, if these are several ifs, if A, they're one of the conceptions of the artistic experience, is that it inevitably pushes certain kinds of boundaries. So then the question I want to ask is whether the kind of halachic writing expressed in Shu'at Amanut is a useful way of addressing the people who have that experience. Or whether we just say, it doesn't talk to you, that's because you're messed up and you need to find ways in which this is in fact a language. Right? Or we say that this is not actually the right way, or we say that, we're not interested in addressing your experience. We're going to make a pragmatic calculation as to what the rules are, and then you have to play within them, right? We're not really talking to your experience at all. I could talk about whether this, right? That's why, Adafka gave you the codification version of this, right? It may be that the tshuvot are different than the sikumim.
But this, right, this, I have it somewhere around here, right? You have the copy of Shulamanut, right? Did I put it on the table somewhere? You know, but I brought the actual book in to show you, right? And it was on a table somewhere. Did it disappear?
I took it back.
All right, somewhere around here. All right, so I gave it to you. First of all, you know, it's the book on the... Here we are.
Okay.
Fun, you can see that they're trying to integrate.
Brilliant graphic design.
So that summary is the sikkum of the first section of the book, right? So this is the right, so this is a fair representation of if you read halacha books the way most people do, is you skip to the sikkum at the end, right? So if you're an artist, you pick this up, that's what you'll get. Right, you'll get that first section, page 51, and then you write the end of it. So I want to know is that the way to have the conversation? Is it useful? That's the big question that I want in your heads, and we can go through the specific models. We can talk about the general question of whether censorship is ever a viable model at all for addressing things, right? And so, but censorship is a power model, right? Censorship just tells you what the rules are, but tells you that somebody has the power to enforce those rules on X. Right? In the same way, there's a difference between a conversation about what the dress code in a school ought to be and how the dress code ought to be enforced. Right? So it might be there's a great deal of value in a dress code, and it's generally a terrible idea to try to enforce it. Right? Those are or at least the theoretical dress code, enforcing the theoretical dress code is often deeply problematic. Because the power relationship may be worse than what you write. So it may be that you should write this halacha and then say, you know what, but we leave it entirely up to you to decide whether you live by it. Now that raises questions, because when you come to art, people want to display it. Right? So at some point, even if you don't censor the production, at some point you're going to censor the display. Right? You'll ask the question, can I put this up in my school or not? And that, you know, that creates very different, very different kinds of images, right? And okay, now the two areas that show up in the introduction of that book, the first two areas deal with isurim of creating certain kinds of religious imagery, and the other deals with creating certain kinds of erotic imagery. And those, to me, it seems to me, are pretty good proxies for the first kinds of issues that show up in art, although we'll deal with the whole notion of what it means, for example, just to portray doubts. Right? What does it mean, right? You know, how do we relate halachically to the notion of writing a short story that powerfully portrays the experience of religious doubt? Is that the same thing as publishing a survey? Right? Or is it, right, we say, look at that, it's Macy's and Medea. Right? Up till now, 94% of the students in this institution have never had any doubts whatsoever about the existence of God, and now you're validating it, or even more powerfully. Up till now, 94% of the students in this institution have been unwilling to talk about their doubts, and therefore will live as if they have none. Right? But now that you are validating the experience of doubt, so they can talk about it. And once you talk about things, eventually hit the tipping point, and everyone will realize everyone else has doubts also, and the whole system will break down. Which is not ridiculous. Right? Many things society only survive because they're not talked about. And it'll be much better as long as you can keep it down to the point where people aren't consciously being hypocritical, then it works really well to keep people from talking about things. I tend to think there's a tipping point at which it becomes ridiculous to not talk about it, but there's a lot of value in certain things in not talking about them. Okay, so then moving from there, so with all these caveats, that it's not clear that the standard halachic language is a useful mode of addressing these kinds of issues, I don't have a non-standard halachic language. So now we're going to pretend that all that didn't happen, and we're going to have a perfectly normal halachic conversation for a while. Or at least, you know, some kind of normal halachic conversation. Now, there is an open question as to whether it is legitimate to introduce Torah into a halachic conversation. Because maybe we, or at least unmediated Torah. Right? Maybe we should only introduce Pesukim through the right through the rabbinic interpretation. And here I'm going to be against my pedagogic statement. I'm going to say, no, you know what? Let's look at pshat first, at least as a framework for understanding what it is that Chazal are accomplishing. So I ask you, right, if you just had these tukim, and I think I've given you a representative set of the psukim, pretty comprehensive in terms of chumash, and I think two useful things in terms of the rest of Nach. So what is it, based on these psukim, that is forbidden in the way of nonverbal representations? Actually, I wouldn't say nonverbal. I wouldn't say representations. What is it that is forbidden in the way of nonverbal production? Based on this. Okay, Izidi, what do you start with?
Idols are things that could very easily be used as idols.
What's an idol?
Seems like it could be any type of, any number of types of things, things that would be tempted to worship.
That doesn't help me any, right? You know, some people are tempted to worship genders. You know, how do I know in advance?
That.
How do I know in advance? Whether it's, you know, how do I know in advance whether, right? You know, that's tautologous, right? So we forbid anything which could be worshipped. But that, you know, there's a lot more language in there. So what do you do with, why do we have these concrete descriptions just to tell you everything?
It seems to be broad, right? They're giving you the plethora of concrete descriptions to say, right? This or this or this or this or the other. I mean, probably genders wouldn't fall into this, into the categories, but they seem to include things like animals, things like people, things like celestial bodies.
Uh-huh. And what kind of things about people and animals and celestial bodies?
Images, is there?
Images?
Yeah.
What's an image?
A visual representation.
How many dimensions?
Not clear. It seems to indicate three, but I'm not sure it's absolutely certain on that. The pestle holds me now.
So what's the difference? Let's start with that. What's the difference between a pestle and tmuna?
Are you still asking me? Or
yeah.
If I had to answer right away, I would say one is three-dimensional, one is two-dimensional.
Uh-huh. So either two or three dimensional representations of anything which is in... Now, do you assume that the list of Tavnit Kols is parallel to this?
In what sense?
That Lo tatzel lecha pesel v'chol tmuna asher b'shamayim v'al v'asher b'aretz mitachas v'asher b'mayim mitachas v'aretz means zachar nekeva behema zippor kanav. It's all the one prohibition. The same, whatever, you assume it's all one prohibition. These all conflate into a ban on basically visual representation of celestial bodies, subterranean bodies, whatever they may be, anything, and any animal or, okay, and a pestle or a tmuna. Okay, we don't know what a pestle or tmuna is, right? Maybe doing like this against the light is also, right? Look, I'm making a dog, right? we could be in trouble also. Happily, there are no shadows in this room. So what other image do we have? Right? What are the terms we have? We have pestle, a tmuna, what else? What other words there in Chumash to describe what we have?
Tavnit.
We have a tavnit. Okay. And?
Masecha.
And a masecha. Okay. So we have all sorts of descriptions. And then what's the last one?
Semel.
And then we have a semel. Right? Semel is a really interesting word, right? Because we have Semel, it's not clear whether semel is a variant of tmuna and pesel and tavnit, or whether semel is a variant of the zachar nekeva behemah. Right, which way does it go? Right, which list is it on? Right, is it tmuna kol semel in the same way it's pesel kol tmuna in it, right, in dvarim? So what is a semel? If you look it up, what do you get? What's a semel? A symbol. So that means it doesn't require the representational at all, right? So and right then we ban everything, just the
symbols are representational.
But tavnit kol semel, right? So what is it that I could make that wouldn't be a semel?
Non-representational, like patterns. Right?
Why isn't the symbol
non-symbolic
non-symbolic patterns?
Yeah.
Decorative patterns. So, and the semel is purely contextual then. So, So I cannot make a tavnit of anything, or a pesel or a tmunah, because we're conflating, of anything that that society finds meaningful. All right. We haven't done that yet, no? That could be that you can make it. But how do you...
I thought that's where you were going when you were asking which category goes in the
same. No, what I was asking is whether a semel is... Well, I was asking whether a semel bans a representation of one of the other things, or whether we ban it... I guess if you frame it that way, right? Or whether it's... or whether we're banning... If that was the question you were asking...
If we're banning
I don't think that the representation of a symbol would be in contrast to the symbol. Right? I think that's just tautology. There is no such thing as a symbol. What would it mean to ban a symbol without a representation?
Well, I mean, I guess if you see something in nature that is symbolic to you, and then you represent it.
Yes.
As opposed to making a peace sign, which you're creating a symbol.
Right, so what I'm claiming is that if you read semel as an alternative to tmunah, so that means that the only thing that's banned is some form of representation of something else.
Yeah.
Whereas if you say a semel is like zachar nekeva, then it means you can't even write a peace symbol. Yeah, exactly. If that's what the question is, yes, that's what I'm suggesting. No, if a semel is like a zachar nekeva, that means, right, so you can't make male and female, and you also can't make other symbols. But if a semel is parallel to tmunah, that means you can't draw an actual depiction of its of zachar nekeva, and you also can't do a symbolic depiction of a zachar nekeva.
I'm saying like zachar nekeva that it's parallel, and that a tavnit zachar nekeva isn't an actual zachar nekeva, it would be a tavnit of one. So then a tmunah kol semel would be not an actual semel, but a tmunah.
You think it's tmunah of a semel?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that. And the question is, tmunah is banned of a semel and a tavnit of zachar nekeva, or do you conflate them? That you cannot make either a tmunah or a tavnit of either a semel or a zachar nekeva. I'm open to any of those possibilities.
Does semel mean symbol?
And the next question is, does semel mean symbol, right? So what do you think semel means?
Time.
I don't know.
Okay.
Siman is Mishnaic, I assume. I don't know. Okay, so we should all...
What are the concepts of show up in
the... Good question. I'll leave it out. Leave all those questions out for you. What I would say is that we start off by saying that you have, that Chazal have a catalog of types of things that they can prohibit. Right, they can prohibit tavnit, tmunot, and psalim, and possibly samalim, and they have a catalog of things that are thereby represented that they can ban, which are zachar nekeva, behema, sipor, remes, daga, shemesh, yireach, kochavim, things that are shemayim mimal, the arts mitachas, and the mayim mitachas arts. That's their whole. They also have. They also have Evan Maskis and Maseva and Masecha and Maseide Harash, right? They have this whole context. We have an addition in two places in Navi where the word Tavnit seems to describe things that are really awful, and they're Tavnitim of a shore, or right? With the Egel HaZahav is a Tavnit, right? We get that, right? By Amirat Kodam the Tavnit Shore, right? It's from the Egel HaZahav. I have this image of Yechezkel, who somehow sees a tavnit, but a tavnit here is not freestanding. A tavnit is on the kir somehow, saviv, in image. Okay, so it sounds like we shouldn't be able to limit a tavnit to freestanding statuary if that's what we wanted to. Assuming that Yechezkel, you all know that Yechezkel is not a reliable source of halacha. So we have to, right, and terms can change meaning. Okay, now I suggested that as part of the background of this, you have to see that that at least in Dvarim there is this constant emphasis of utumna in chamroim ki lo ritem kol tumna. Right, that the tumna specifically is what the Jews did not see at Har Sinai.
Whoa.
Sorry. okay, I think we found the leak. I think we found the leak, so perhaps we should tell them that.
Is that what they're looking to fix?
That's what they're looking to fix? Alright, when they come in again, perhaps we'll move to the social and tell them we have located the problem.
Hey, now we have a leak inside.
Oh. Okay, I'll do it then.
Okay. So I think that the absence of a tumna is a function. Really, you have to read these psukim, or at least you're entitled to read the psukim against two anxieties. One is the constant, you didn't see a tumna, and the other is that the creation of the Egel HaZahav afterwards was a bad thing. And now you then have to decide what you think the Egel HaZahav was. Do you think the Egel HaZahav was the worship of a different god? Do you think the Egel HaZahav was a representation of God? Do you think the Egel HaZahav was a representation of the chariot of God, whatever you may think? But you have to read the bands in light, right? In light of those things. Okay. So with that, we moved on to the it's leaking right over there. Right, Emily, one. Right, it's right above.
Right.
There.
Cool. Now we're looking into it. Thank you.
okay. So let's go to the shul code. I warn you up front, I think I made at least one mistake punctuating it. So we'll see if any of you catch it. I can't prove it, but I think I made at least one. Did I build a cloud of protocol? I didn't remember to notice that one. Oh, okay, that's a typo. There's one thing I got wrong. That's just a typo. There's one thing. No, one thing where I just misunderstood a sentence, I think.
Yeah, later on.
Good. Okay, you already caught it. Fine. Which one? Let me get there. Okay. Good. Anyway, let's see. Jared, do you want to start reading it?
All right. The Asir Lahon, the Devei Yisrael, the Ma'avad, Dmut, Shmashim, the Kutcha Briefel.
Okay, what does that mean?
So it's Asir for Devei Yisrael to make images of the utensils, the things, server,
upper
thing of God.
Okay. So we don't know what Shamashin are yet.
Right.
Right? And it's to... So what, how do you translate Lame'avad Bidmut?
It's to make the utensils of God.
Okay. So we have to be very... So we have that word images again. Right? So we have to be very, very, very careful to figure out what exactly... Right, what exactly is dmut is, right? You know, right, for Tanakh purposes, we have to distinguish between a telem and a dmut and trying to figure out what's going on in Breshit. Right? And the Rambam goes to great length to try and distinguish them. But for now, we'll just say, okay, you cannot make a dmut of Shamashin. Okay, why not? So what does that mean?
When persons don't make with me,
mm-hmm.
means don't make images
of what is with me. How does it mean
that?
There's a missing word there. Yeah. So what word is missing? Mashe. Mm-hmm. Well, this is Mashe Iti, okay. And how does Mashe Iti mean Shamashin?
I mean, it was sort of later on. If we're talking about the Mishkan, the things that are in the Mishkan where God is sort of hanging out.
Uh-huh. Okay. But not, so it has to be things that are exclusively with me, so it doesn't mean oxygen or things like that, which
right.
are presumably also in the Mishkan. Right?
Right.
So things that are with God and things that are with God purposefully. Right? That's what Shamashin are. And, right? We haven't located the Mishkan at all yet, though. We don't know, right? We just know God is somewhere. And we're not allowed to do things that are, we're not allowed to make things that are in the dmut of those things that are with God wherever God is. Okay, good. What else do we learn?
Continue? Yeah. So you can't even don't do it,
don't make it even for other
people
that
you're yourself are not going to be using.
Uh-huh.
The
asiyah
kakapikra,
because
making it itself is
what the Torah
is
prohibiting. Right? Well, at least they haven't made... All right, we're going to go on and we're going to pretend, right? Where's the film going here? And we're just going through. Yeah. We may yet have to, but I'm hesitant. Pardon? Maybe, you know what, perhaps we should try a better course of valor. Let's, everyone has enough power for 20 minutes. Why don't we move into the shul? You can leave the stuff here, yeah. Unless, you know, if you have anything that you would be seriously word damaged, you might know. Coming through the light fixture, so we've cleared out of the room now. There's another leak coming through a light fixture in that side.
I can't do anything until you're out of the room.
We're out of the room.
Oh, beautiful. We'll move right in. Thank you.
The Torah cares about asiya, and therefore, if other people make them, Jews can use them. Good. Well, I don't know if that yet. Right. So, good. So now we can have a moment of lumdus. Right. So, what does it tell you about the asir?
It's
a gavra to make it, as opposed to the chesra existing. Right. So, why would we? Right. What is now? I'll ask you a non-Brisker question, I guess, or a Shemesh Kav question. So what is this about? Right? Why would there be an Isser to ban making certain things? We don't care about them being existent.
The idea that you can create it,
it's something about the experience of creation, per se. As opposed to existence of the object, that seems like a reasonable possibility. It's another way of saying it, Isser Gavra, right? In another way of framing it, right? It's something about you, not about the thing. Ora, what did you want to say? Well, is the image of God or the image? Right, we're talking about Shamashim, but let's be careful. So you want, right? We want it to be an image of God. Right, we want it very much to be an image of God, but it doesn't say that yet. Right, so I'm only talking about shamashim. So you can't create images of God's shama, images of God's, or dmut, I shouldn't say images. You can't create dmuyot of things that are with God, and things that are, and a term that seems coterminous with God right now is to be a shamash.
Okay, and then we're also, right, as Sarah's about to tell us, we're also not chayash lichshada. Okay, so to be not chayash lichshada means, on the narrowest sense, well, let's contextually, what would be the chashad be?
I guess that they made it.
Chashad would be that you made it.
Or that you're worshiping it, I'm not sure.
So you could say worshiping it, but no one mentioned anything about worshiping anything so far, right? Nobody said any purpose, what I'm trying to make very clear. Nobody said anything here that the issue has anything to do with Avodah Zarah per se.
Right.
Right, that's why I want you to read the Shiltos before you read anything else. Right, because what we have is that in the Pesukim there is good contextual reason for assuming we're talking about Avodah Zarah. Right, but in the Shiltot, at least at this stage, nobody has mentioned anything about Avodah Zarah, and the Chashad straightforwardly is the Chashad that you made this thing. That's true. It's entirely possible that there's a whole separate set of Yisurim which is unconnected to this. Right? This is solely pshat in Lo Sasun Iti, and Lo Sasun Iti records a different set of Yisurim than Lo Yeh Lecha Lim Echrim Al Tanai and Lo Tasel Lecha Pesel Kol Tmuna, all those other sukkim. Right? So as opposed to Yedidya's claim earlier that we're conflating them all into one Yisur, right, we can claim that at least there are two totally distinct kinds of Isurim. What about Lotos and Iti? What about everything else? Okay, absolutely. And we could even claim that the Chashad is about different Isurim than this one. But it seems to me that the parsimonious way of reading it is to say that, right, Pashut, that if there's a prohibition against making something, so then it's reasonable to say that if you have something, people will accuse you of having, he'll accuse you of having made it, and the answer is no. You don't worry about that for whatever reason. Maybe because we just, everyone knows it's mutter to have it and not to do it. Everyone has someone else do it for them. Right, that's all. Okay, and then we have a Braita, which is supposed to prove something, right? So what does the Braita prove? Let's answer the question. What does the Braita prove? Okay, right, so you acquire a chatzer, which is mitzvah, right, and that would be an example of having things that other people made for you, right, and the fact that you can acquire a chatzer which has things other people made for you implies that it's not prohibited to have things other people made, which is not prohibited either as chashad or as losasuniti, right, so it just proves it's mutter. Okay, fine. That is true, but it's hard to imagine this mutter drabbanan and asur d'oraisa.
No, I mean, of course. I mean, it's not true. It's not because the Eber proof is that you can have things which are the existence of the category of things that are also about the and not in maintaining ownership, or whether it's purely for proving that when there is such a category that we don't worry about shot.
Yes. That's true. I would agree with you that probably this relates to the chashad issue. That's why I indented it that way. But I want to be open to the possibility that it's not. That it's actually directly proving the question, the issue that you can use things other people made. Okay, and here we have, right, there's a claim that there's a text which talks about a chatzer mifuyechet and mitsuyeret. What does mifuyechet mean? Like what? Had soot on it. Maybe. That's what? That's what Mifuyechet means. So what does Mifuyeret mean? Black and white.
I don't know. So we should hold that. We should hold that in mind, right? Because we should hold that in mind. The Lechora, these are things that you're not allowed, right? That these are things you're allowed to buy, but not allowed to make. Right? That seems to be the claim here. Right? That you would not be allowed to be mifayech and mitzayer your chaser yourself. I don't want to talk about that yet. Short answer, of course, is no. Not this brayta, exactly. So let's talk about what this means. Right, not this girsa of this brayta would be a more precise way. Part of why I gave you the shilta first. Okay. Now, what's the obvious problem with this brayta? Right, what do you have to assume about the chatzer in order for it to be a raya? Okay. Yeah. Or about the piyuach and siur, whichever you want, right? Yes, Rachel. Good. And what? And in order to have that be true, what do you have to assume? In order to accomplish that, what do you have to assume? No, because it could be. We don't know if non-Jews are prohibited to do this or not. What are the tsurim of? Who said avodah zarah? Where does it say avodah zarah in the text? In this context, what do they have to be tsurim of? Who? You can answer this way. What do they have to be tsurim of? One Hebrew word has to be tsurim of. What's the only thing we know about so far? We haven't heard about the heichal yet. They have to be tsurim of shamashim, right? I think it's mashi iti. Okay, good. So this is why it matters. That's right. That's why I asked that question. Right? Because if you say that this is just proving generically that we never care about a chashad, that you made something just because you have it, right? Then we don't require the chaser to be mitsuyar with shamashim specifically. Right? But if you need this to be proving that it's, right, if you need this text to prove to you that it's okay to have mut shamashim, then we have to assume that the tsurim are the mut shamashim.
Why do you need to write the chaser? It's possible.
That you can keep them?
Yeah.
So who says that?
Right? The Asiyah is coming from.
Right, that's what he's saying, but he understands you might not think that. Right? So he's bringing a bright to say that's true the halacha, because Pasuk can't prove you that we're not choshesh b'chashad. If we're talking about chashad, right? So chashad is the Rabbanan. So you can't use the Pasuk to prove that.
Right, but you can use the bright to prove chashad.
That's right, but the question is, you're using the bright to prove chashad generically. Yes.
Does that happen a lot?
Why not? You're a later figure. You say the pasuk must mean that, right? Or now, you can even do it within chashad. The question is, are we proving the generic question that we're not chosheish, that we're not worried that people will think that something you possess is automatically something you made? Or the specific question, we're not worried that people will think that you made it with shamash. But if there's something else is prohibited to make, we might very well prohibit your keeping it also.
Right.
Yeah, it might be, right, I say that the problem with making it a generic proof, right, which is what Jonathan wanted to argue, is that who says that's true? The problem, either way, though, is the text doesn't tell us what it's on the theory. So how can you bring it, right, how do you bring a raya from this brayta to anything? When the brayta does, all the brayta tells us, for all we know, the brayta has Mickey Mouse on it. Unless you think that Mickey Mouse is somehow with God. Right, Mickey Mouse is the shamash. Right. So why should that be? So you might be, there's a cultural presumption. Everyone knew what kind of theorem you would draw on the wall. But right now I just leave it as a deep problem. Right. The alternative is to claim that of course all theorem are forbidden. Period. Right. And we take Kol Semel as the dispositive.
We don't know the entire Braita. It could be a textual error in the Shiltot as well. I don't know of any. The alternate versions of the Braita have different words for Mifuyechad or Mitzuyeret, but I don't know of one that describes specifically what the content of the pictures is. We'll see. We'll go look eventually at the sugya where this shows up. But as you can imagine, it's not a Avodah Zarah sugya or a Tzavad Heichal. It's a real estate sugya. Right, it's telling you about what kind of it's in a sugya. It's interested in chatzerim. It's not interested in this at all. And so it's hard to know anything from it. I find it interesting, Rayas, how you know the only way to really logically to make sense of it is to claim that all tzirim are forbidden. But there's no basis earlier in the Shiltot for saying that. Or to say it's just the chashad thing. So then again, but the chashad means that some theorem, it has to be forbidden to make these theorem for the chashad to be relevant.
Yeah, but it could be also for other reasons aside.
That's fine, but so all theorem are forbidden for other reasons. That's fine, right? But it still has to...
Or not all theorem in general, maybe it could be just having a chaser mitziar.
Okay, there could be a different prohibition against specifically a chaser mitziar that we've never heard of. Right, against decorated chaserim, it's also possible. I don't know, I haven't heard of one, so I don't know of it. Right, so you can limit it to claiming that there's, right, the question is, the problem is that he's quoting another text, right, if the Gemara did this, right, we would, right, so we would say, okay, the Gemara knows the context, but he doesn't, right, we don't know, right, but he's claiming that there's a text somewhere else that he can use as proof, and we don't know that he has any access to that text that we don't have, right, there's no, so I want to know is how he can take a text which, that's excellent. What do you think Harizut Chaskata means? No, that can't be what Harizut Chaskata means. Right? Harizut Chaskata is a halakha, right? You took a chaser, right? And which because it was Mitzuyech and Mitzuyeret, you might think, right, was not the Chaskata, or alternatively, that despite the fact that it was Mitzuyech and Mitzuyeret, you might think was, right, We don't know why Reza Bechaz Kata is a Chiddush, right? Really, it shouldn't be Bechaz Kata, but now it is Bechaz Kata because of Mitziyaret. Or whether, right? We don't, right? It could be either way.
Even though.
Right? It could be even though it's Mitziyaret, it could be because it's Mitziyaret. We don't know which one. Could be despite.
It's one chapter.
Yeah.
Why? In the case of a normal case of one chapter, why would you use
it in the case of Mitziyaret? What does Bechaz Kata mean? I don't know. Right? Before we bring this as a proof, we have to know what Arizut B'chazkata means. We don't figure that out, so we don't know which way the Mifuyechad Mitziyaret applies. But I just point out, so far as we know, the author of the Shiltot has no access to the sprites of the Yama we have, which means that he doesn't know what the pictures are. Right? So any raya which depends on the pictures being a certain kind is problematic, because we have no way of, we have no reason to believe that he knows what's on within the picture.
Is there any point of picture
in
at all
of
it would give you special information on?
I don't know. Who says we're talking about owning? I don't know what Chaskata means. When we find out what Chaskata means, then I can talk about what pictures matter, assuming that Mitzvah really means pictures. What I want to point out right, is that we should be very careful about assuming things when we don't know what's the we don't have basic background. And the astonishing to me is that the Shiltot puts in this huge assumption, which I don't justify. I don't presume I know anything about this text at all. I don't know what piyuch means. I don't know what tziur means. I don't know b'chazkatam. Okay.
So we go on, we have a braita, which says, lo tasuriti, lo tasin shimushi. Now, what word is missing in that braita? Dmut. Okay, so we have to ask ourselves, right, so now we ask ourselves, what's the connect, right? Is this coming to, is it working to agree with or to disagree with the previous claim? Okay, the problem is the word dmut shows up immediately, right? You go dmut heichal, dmut shulchan, dmut menorah. So it leaves dmut out at the beginning and it puts dmut at the end. Now here we have a description, here we have a definition of shimushim, namely shimushim are the heichal, the shulchan, and the menorah, and we are told that these are examples. Right, the question is, when you have a list of examples, the question is what example? The examples all share something in common. Right, examples all share something, right? They're all Mishkan related, or Beit HaMikdash related. So is this telling us that the only prohibition of Shimushim is things that are in the Mishkan or the Mikdash? And even within them, right, are there even a subcategory where we say the Heichal, what about is it prohibited to make the Mizrakot? Right, why is it the, is it only the utensils or is it even the, right, is it even, let's say, the Ketoret? Right, things like that. We don't know the answer to that either. They have another Braita which records a machloke between Rebbe and Rabbi Yossi of Rabbi Huda. Pardon? Rabbi Huda, or the... I don't know. Right now I'm just cataloging. We have a braita which says Shamashim and doesn't define him at all. We have another braita which says Shamashim and gives a set of examples. Okay? Although we point out that the first braita puts the word mut into the midrash and the second one does not. Right? Then I have a third braita which gives a different set of examples. Doesn't quote the pasuk specifically. Right, the third braita doesn't tell us that it's midrash halacha at all. It just says a person should not do this, and then gets into a fun tangential machlokas about whether the prohibition against making the menorah specifically relates to all materials or only some materials. Okay, we don't even know if that one's the oraita, but it sounds like the prohibition is. Again, right, anything that would be kosher in the Beit HaMikdash is usher to make, anything which would be possible in the Midrash is mutter. Which is in itself, right, as opposed to, but not the thing which is in the Beit HaMikdash now. Right? Pardon? But it could be the Midrash applies only if you can't have another thing out there when there is something in the Beit HaMikdash. Right? But it sounds like it's not related to copying an existing Beit HaMikdash, it sounds like it's related to copying things that would theoretically be in the Beit HaMikdash, even though they're not there now. Sounds like, right? Sounds like that's most likely.
Or at least that once were.
Well, except that not clear, right? Because there are things that never were in the Beit HaMikdash, but would hypothetically be kosher that are still forbidden. And there never was a silver menorah, right? But if a silver menorah is kosher, it's still forbidden.
Well, no.
Yes, okay. So, but the person who bans silver would also ban platinum, lechora, even though there never was a platinum one. Okay. Right, then we go, right, then as well as we have this Baram Tsarich, we have to ask who the machloket is like, and we have a whole discussion over who the machloket is like. Then we have this peculiar Inami. Okay, so Inami generally, right, introduces an alternative. Right, the problem is an alternative to what? I have no idea what Inami means in the Shulchan. So, right. So that's the question. Right. The question: what is the Shulchan doing? And now all of a sudden, the Shulchan introduces after this Inami, which I don't really understand at all, introduces two possible Okimta. Right. One is Shamashin Sheifshar LaSot Kimotan, Kiyom Bayad Klisharis. Right. But what about Shamashin Shei Efshar LaAsotan, which the example is the Chama, the Levana, and the Malachei HaSharet. And the question, Lechora, is, does the prohibition Lo Ta'asuni Ti extend beyond things that you can make copies of to things that you cannot make copies of. Right? Does anyone have a different understanding of the Ashar Lasot Kimotan? Right, I can make an exact copy of anything in the Mishkan, because who made the things in the Mishkan? Men, people, whatever, right? They all did it, right? They all did it, right? So what about things that God made that we can't make? Now the problem is, what would the prohibition be? Right, you can't make them. So here's where the word mut comes up. Right. So here it's very midiyak, right? Shamashin is right. Shamashin the shalosot kimatan can go and buy it, right? Ukli sharei. But shamashin she yestarla kimatan it can go and demut chama, demut levana, demut. Right. So here all of a sudden we have a recognition that there are really two kinds of prohibition. One is a prohibition against imitation, and the other is a prohibition against representation. Right. And these are right. And the question the shulchan asks is: do we extend the prohibition from imitation to representation, or from copying, right, to representation? And the answer is that we have both frames. The first version is kaven diefshar lasot kimotan. It's permitted velo klum kaavid. Right, this is a very powerful term. Right, what would be prohibited? Right, what would be prohibited? Right, you can't do it. And the pasuk says, "Lo ta'asuni ti." So where would we get right? Where would you get the idea that it's prohibited to make things that you can't make? Okay, so here, right, the Shulah puts in a fascinating second of the Havim. Maybe we say, "Mash iti is ikar b'malachei hasharet." Now we have a wild reading of the pasuk. "Lo ta'asuni ti" includes two kinds of things: things that are really iti, and things that are not so much iti. The things that are not so much ET, what's prohibited is exact copies. The things that are really ET
are extraterrestrial.
Right? We prohibit the mood. Interesting question of whether that means we would permit the mood of a Bayan Heichal. The earlier Brightness said not. So we have to go both ways. We say pardon? So Machonah Mikdash is in trouble, right? If the mood is also because anything Lekora, we should say that anything that represents the Bayit Kli Sharet should be forbidden, just like anything that represents the Chama Levana and the Malachi HaSharet. Okay, right. So which of these is true? So we have two bright dots. One, pardon? Before the Inami, the only thing we've mentioned is the Kli Sharet.
No, assuming that the Shamashin DVD is not what is later explained here in the Inami. Right?
So you want to have the headline is with Shamashim, and the first possibility is Shamashim Shev Shalos Hokamatan, and Inami maybe even includes Shamashim Shev.
Right, I mean, Inami is saying, right, is it that, right, those, the two, that which is also are both the Shamashim that are
could be. I don't know what the word inami is then.
Right. No, inami is the second, right? The first possibility is the first full discussion, right?
But the inami introduces the two possibilities, hanimili or odilma.
Right, and that's the problem. That here you have the two possibilities again.
Yeah, that's why it doesn't work for me. Okay. We have a right. Then we have a bright. Then we have two brights that introduce this Tashma and Hani Idach. One right, each of which explicitly includes shamashim that you cannot make, but the question is, do they, are they supplementary, meaning that we now forbid both kinds of shamashim she'afshar lasot, or alternative? Right, malachei asherah is opposed to chama levana. We don't know how they relate to each other either, right? So now we have three different types of objects that could be forbidden, all of which are shamashim, right? We have kli sharet, we have malachim, and we have celestial objects. And then we have this question of no words, with adam minayim. Right, up till now, right, previously it was suggested as an alternative. Maybe shamashim she'af sharet motan are forbidden, maybe not. Now, Dvud Adam Minayin assumes that we know that Dvud Adam is forbidden. Okay, now, the answer to Dvud Adam Minayin is not Tavnit Zachar Nekeva. Right, so right, that pasuk never comes into play in the Shulchan at all. The answer is wild drasha, right? Lo tasuni ti, lo tasuni oti. This is the mistake I thought I made, by the way. Is this what you guys thought? It's not clear to me that it should be im shmiel li kribe, because that phrase doesn't appear anywhere else in rabbinic literature. I suspect that probably it's in Pirkei Derav im shmiel li or something like that. I just don't know. And there's something, right? When you get to the Gemara, you'll see why I think that. But whatever it means, it seems to be there's some kind of wild kriyuktiv or yesh ein lamikra, yesh ein lamasoret, where we turn iti into oti, and then we turn oti into human beings. Right? The parts of human beings. How did that happen? How seriously we take creativity? Is this in addition to ET, or as opposed to ET? And what does it mean to say that the Partuf Adam is making God? Right, Tzelel Elokim, right? This is like in the guise of forbidding anthropomorphism. Right, we're thinking about anthropomorphism again. Right, don't make images of God because God is a person. Because God looks like a person. That's really wild. Right, then what are we trying to do here? What are we really prohibiting, right? If that's part of the same prohibition, right? Don't make, right? Now we have one overall prohibition, which is don't make images of God or anything close to God. But it's not because we don't think God is an image, right? To ban the Partuf Adam because that is too close to God is not in any way diminishing people's attachment to anthropomorphism. Right, so right, so we have to be very clear. One reason for banning these things is that we want to remove people's presumption that God has an image, and making images of God has the right falsely entrenches the notion. But if we ban these things because they are images of God, then you're creating the absolute opposite theological perspective. Everyone knows the reason we can't make images of God is because you're not allowed to make images of human beings, is because you're not allowed to make images of God. Right, so it's a very different question, right, of what the thing is supposed to prohibit, and that ends up with the claim. Doesn't say Dvud here. Well, it says Dvud Adam Minayin, right?
And Dvud there is important, right? Because that's the basis of Drasha, right? Presumably, the unspoken part of Drasha is not other than
And also the Dvud Elokim Asav,
right? Presumably, the word Dvud here is Dvud. Right? Dvud Adam Minayin, how do you know it's OT? Right? But that's all, the whole basis of Drasha. We'll talk about T. Don't make my Dvud. And the only thing we know that is my Dvud is man. Right here, Dvud is very, it is not, it's presumably functionally part of unspoken Drasha.
It would be nice if it said, Lo tasun iti, kribe lo tasun oti, meaning lo tasun bidmuti.
They're not bidmuti, meaning apoti, right? Because man is the dmut of God.
Because making a dmut, we're not talking about making a human being, we're talking about making a dmut of a human being.
Right.
So a dmut of a human being is, right, is at best a dmut of a dmut.
Well, dmut there doesn't mean, right, it's bidmut.
I'm not sure. So I'm not sure how much weight to put on that claim. That's the right. That's the short answer. I'm not sure how much weight to put on. Yes, you do.
No. So we don't have to say that the mood is necessarily representation of something that's about latent.
I don't know. You know, and it's permitted to have children. This is always the problem with it. We create human beings all the time.
Well, is it really creating there, or is it?
I know, but there are lots of, you know.
Like, it would be like Frankenstein or something.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. It's problematic. That's why I need a bracha for vu, because otherwise it would be usher, because it would be imitating God too much. Possible. Cool. Right? You know. we should certainly need a bracha, yeah? Why, where did we say that, God? Where did we say that? It's unspoken. Maybe be careful of unspoken assumptions.
Okay. So working at least in the 21st century, my people believing that the existence of God is not something that is being taught to the
community. I can see this would be disturbing. Right. This wouldn't. I mean, it's not a 21st century problem, right? You'll discover that that from the 11th through 15th centuries, from the 11th to 20th, they've asked this, right? So you'll have all sorts of. If you look at the Perushim on Chumash, you'll see that they have all sorts of. What it means is, right, to make the dmut of the X Y Z thing, which is right there. Everyone has all that. Has that absolutely. They all put, right, the more you have to put that in, the harder the drasha gets to understand. Right. That's all it is. Right. There's no. I'm not taking. There's Yair Lorberbaum made himself. Right. Wrote the books a couple of years ago, in which he argued that, in fact, there were, and you can see, we may talk about this, that, now Tom Sliskin wrote this piece, right, you can look at rationalist, in Chakira, there was a whole debate about whether Rashi was an anthropomorphist or not. I'm not taking sides on that. I'm just pointing out that this drasha is hard to understand, and it gets harder to understand the less anthropomorphic you get. Right, but many great people have found ways to deal with it. Okay, the last thing is, which is really problematic, is we have this plan, Kolav Partufot Mutarot Kutzmi Partuf Adam, but we just learned that the Dmut Malachim and right are forbidden. Right, so how can it be, right, so how can all the other Partufot be Mutarim? So it must be that that whatever it is you make of the other celestial beings is not a Partuf. Right, that's what it must be. Or these are all Dismi. Okay. Sach HaKol, this is where we finish. What emerges from the Shilta is, the first thing is that there's no mention explicitly. Yeah. Good. It's hard to make. I don't know. It's hard to make because we're all talking about lo tasuni ti. So I'm assuming we're talking about making. Not obvious, but I'm willing to assume that. The Shilta has a whole conversation which talks about malachim and chamal levana and human beings. And the Heichal, in which no mention of Avodah Zarah occurs. Right, that's the first thing I want to go over. Right? You can talk about all these categories of prohibited images without ever mentioning Avodah Zarah. So we have to be careful about whether we want to put Avodah Zarah into this conversation or not, or when we put it in, where we put it in. The nature of the prohibition, right? So the nature of the only restrictions that the Shiltzot seems to know about on the production of representation, unless you have, right? The easy way to bracket all the other Pesukim is to say, of course, it is prohibited to make or maintain any representation for the purpose of worship. And now we're having a discussion of representation. It's not, right? That's Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is to worship stuff. You shouldn't worship stuff. You shouldn't have things that are worshipped. Good. All gone. That has nothing to do with the production of symbolism per se. I have a different question, which is, having bracketed the Avodah Zarah issue, are there further limitations or representation of some form or another? In the Shilta, you can have that conversation without any risk or any involvement of the Avodah Zarah question, so far as we know. Right? The prohibition is the reproduction of things that are religious. Now we can, if we wish, impose on that the claim that the reproduction of such things generate the Avodah Zarah, right? The reproduction of the Beit HaMikdash allows worship outside of the Beit HaMikdash, right? We can impose an Avodah Zarah frame on that. We have no reason for doing that at this stage.
All we have is a set of prohibitions against the production of representations, which, where it seems to be that the ground for prohibition is precisely the closeness of this representation to genuine worship. Because we think this is a me'ila type issue. You're not allowed to use these things for other purposes. It could be because there's a risk of it. There's an avodah zarah type risk. It could be something else we haven't thought of entirely at all. Nor do we have any kind of model for what a representation, for what it means to, for what constitutes a representation. We have the notion of a tavnit for the kelim. And then we have the notion of a demut for other things, and that demut, however, is acknowledged that demut cannot possibly be actual. And then we have a parsuf adam, which is an entirely different category at all. Okay, there's no legal description for all, right? As an extreme case, it could be that the prohibition against making a demut malach is any symbol you wish whatsoever, right? You make up some kind of line and you say this is the angel formerly known as prince or something, right? And it becomes forbidden, right? Because who says that there's any such form as a representation of a malach, right? Malach has no form. A second claim is to say no, that we do the Alan Mirat approach. And we say that what is prohibited is the representation of a malach in any way in which a malach is described as not. We don't grant any halachic legitimacy to non-prophetic experience. Right, which means that you can create your own cultural symbol for a malach whenever you want to. Right, so if you think a malach, for example, looks like a vulture, right, you just draw your malachim with funny eyebrows, right, and pointed ears, and that's fine. Right, because no navi ever described malachim that way, and as long as they're carefully distinguishable from human beings, you're fine. Okay, so what I wanted to do was just put on the table that's the way the Shulchan has the conversation. As we go back and look at the Sugya of the Gemara, we're going to have to figure out what the relationship that is, and that's why it's important to mention the scholarly conflict about the Shulchan. There are two shitot about the Shulchan. One version of the Shulchan is that it's just an early commentary on the Gemara, and the other version of the Shulchan is that it actually is a precursor to the Gemara. But it's a representation of the oral tradition, which was frozen at some point in the Gemara in a box somewhere, but there was an oral tradition of learning that sustained itself, that really, you know, goes on as if the Gemara didn't happen, and that's what the Shulta really is, or it's like proto-Gemara. That's why the problem with that is that, as you can see in the Shulta, we don't really understand what the connections are. We don't understand how you get from point A to point B. And that way it's very much like the Yerushalmi. So we don't know what this Shulta means. We don't know what halakhic authority it has. I wanted you to see first the text that didn't have Avodah Zarah in it, because you can see that all of you immediately jumped to Avodah Zarah. Right? So I wanted to find a way which I could clearly show you that Avodah Zarah often is not where you want to see it. Now we'll go back to the next again, we'll do an Avodah Zarah, right? So they're all about that. Right? So I want you to be open to the possibility of leaving Avodah Zarah out of the conversation, because right, so one way you will often see the conversation proceeding is if the making of images per se is idolatrous. This is the vision of the artless Jew, that Judaism and the visual representation are viscerally opposed to each other, because we are the religion of the invisible God as opposed to pagans, that there are visible manifestations of God, right, and then we put it in an anti-Christian context, right? That's a particular vision that makes it very, very hard. Right, in that vision, the notion of legitimizing art, right, visual art, automatically puts you in an avodah zarah context. Right, but then there's a second vision, right, which is to say that no, the production of visual images is, in a sense, the visual experience and the production of tangible worship objects is the highest level. Right? What's more kadosh than the production of Klei HaMikdash and the experience of Nevi'im? And so then the question is, it might be that the production of representation is intrinsically a tremendous form of religious expression, which then has to be contained in some way by the concern for not displacing certain authorized things. But there's much more room, right? In the Avodah Zarah vision, so then we have no incentive for finding ways to allow it. Right? The best we can do is to say that we will allow certain technicalities as concessions, right? As concessions to people, right? Let's say the people who think that you're really should be a vegetarian, but because we have people with bloodless, we allow shita. We don't want the shita to leave wood, we allow people to eat the meat. Right? That's one vision. A second vision is that, of course, right, part of the religious experience is to have visual images of God. Now we can talk about, right, and of course there's going to be a drive, right, to concretize those images. Now there are various reasons that we find that risky, right, or that we only allow it perhaps in the context of the Beit HaMikdash or things like that. But intrinsically, we see this as the religious drive. And so our goal is, right, and to tell people that they should stamp this out is, right, it's like, you know, telling the being. The star claim would be that people who wish to completely de-anthropomorphize God would walk over to a Navi and say, stop them. Right? I don't want these kind of images. We want you to experience God rationally.
Well, that's what the being were, weren't
it? What? Pure rationalists?
Yeah.
Well, so we have visions, right? We have visions of the image, which transform them and say that the images that the Nevi'im give you are only to allow the non-Nevi'im, right, the non-philosophers have some notion of what they have, right? We could do that. We don't have to do that. Okay, so I want to set those out as poles for understanding the conversation. That there is a way of envisioning the production of images as a wholly religious act, and then we have the same kind of conversation: is it only religious images, right? Or the same, right? Or is it that this is true of all kinds, right? Of all kinds of images per se, right? Is there value in producing images of anything of God's creation, so long as, right? Okay, and that was over long for even the first day, on a hard day with the thing. I thank you all for your attention, and we should go have a fun moment or half hour. Maybe. Hopefully we haven't been flooded. Let's the schedule for sure. I think I'm the Zima, so you should look. If you don't remember when you were, you should look at it. And I'll be around hopefully most of the afternoon, so you can talk about Thank you.